Circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
Strange days indeed. Most peculiar, Mama. Roll!
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hey, hello, it's good to be in your ears again. This time on Strange Days Indeed, two regular contributors, editorialist Dave Verlott with his take, and our British correspondent and publisher of the New Alien Worlds magazine, Stuart Miller, along with an interview conducted by Mike Wallace back in 1957, a famed UFO researcher and former United States Marine officer Major Donald Kehoe. It's been a busy time, ufologically speaking, since this program was last in your ears. Famed astrophysicist Stephen Hawking has been thinking a lot about the cosmic question, are we alone? The British cosmologist who suffers from ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, and must speak through a mechanical device, was recently seen in a video posted at YouTube where he called you and I, who are interested in UFO-related phenomena, cranks and weirdos. Now, the posting of that video generated many posts to the UFO updates list, among which came these pearls from Don Ledger. Quoting Don, Hawking has been saying that for years. It's a knee-jerk response from him. He's never cracked a book. Wonder what he thinks of Michio Kaku's opposite opinion. Don suggests that many of we cranks and weirdos know more about astronomy and the workings of the universe, the physics, and the theories than Hawking knows about UFOs. And when it comes to this stuff, Don Ledger continues, he has no credentials to make the observation that he did. And thanks to Don Ledger for making those observations. Which leads us very nicely into what Stanton Friedman has been saying for years about the like of Sagan and Hawking, as far as things ufological are concerned. Stan? Stan?
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Verlott.
There's an interesting couple of threads on the UFO updates list, referring to whether or not we'd recognize or be told if we made contact with an intelligence from beyond the borders of our planet. It's an age-old question, because it covers a lot of possibilities, including one I talked about a long time ago. Would anyone even pay attention if we did finally confirm and or meet with another highly evolved intelligent species? SETI, or the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence People, would claim that, of course, we'd pay attention. And they are adamant that they would be able to recognize an attempt to contact us here on the planet. Well, they have to be resolute about such things. If they admitted that they might not be able to recognize an extraterrestrial radio signal of some nature, there is no reason for them to exist. They would also insist that us unwashed masses would learn about the contact simply because there is no way such a confirmed contact could be kept secret. There are many different scenarios to us actually having contact with creatures from another planet. And the first one involves a question that keeps coming up about if they are in fact visiting our planet, why are they not making themselves more widely known to us here? Well, there are many possible answers to that question, including the most basic one being that they really don't care or want to introduce themselves to us. And all of these things have one simple basic fact that we tend to ignore. We assume that an alien species would follow some kind of agenda that we could understand, some kind of an agenda that makes sense to us here on Earth, because surely we are smart enough and advanced enough to be able to logically conclude what anyone would be thinking. Well, asking the question about whether or not we'd be able to identify a signal of contact from some extraterrestrial civilization also has to assume that we have yet to be contacted or visited. But let's not muddy the waters with that one, and we'll visit the question all by itself. Now, if some other civilization wanted to make contact with us, what would they do? Maybe they would put together some kind of broadcast and send it to us through space on some cosmic radio frequency. Or maybe they'd send some broadcast out on a powerful beam of light that would end up cutting a chunk of Earth away like some extraterrestrial scalpel. Or maybe they would show up in some kind of invading armada because the message they ended up getting from Earth was one of the many declarations of war that has been made by any one of a number of nations on this particular planet. And that is the major problem with the whole SETI theory. If some alien civilization does pick up one of the millions of signals that have been broadcast from this planet, we have no way of determining what signal they might intercept. And we also have no way of knowing how they might respond to it, if they decided to respond to it. And one of the reasons that we might have difficulty recognizing contact by some ET species is because they may have decided that we're simply not worth it. We're too stupid, we're too barbaric, we're too violent, or we're simply too ugly to worry about. As the old saying goes, do we actually give any consideration about a colony of ants or what ants are thinking before we step on them? And once again, all of this thinking relies on the fact that we are actually capable of interpreting what an alien brain could be thinking. What is very interesting is that most of our science fiction shows dealing with aliens shows us just about every theory of what could happen if we were contacted. Everything has been covered by one show or movie, including the belief that ET beings would be completely altruistic and want to help our poor barbaric civilization to come out of the darkness and see the light. Or ET might see Earth as some kind of huge cattle farm ready to be harvested. Tonight's special is real Canadian back bacon from a redheaded Canadian. Now, my own personal theory about contact with an extraterrestrial civilization has its foundation built upon our history. And I truly, truly hope that I am wrong, because it starts basically with three little ships showing up on our doorstep and the occupants offering us pretty trinkets and trash to show how nice they are to us. In exchange, of course, for something we might have. And if we decide that we don't want to trade with them, well, they'll simply take it, and we won't be able to do a damn thing to stop them. Now, for those of you wondering what I'm referring to, do a little bit of reading on the interaction between Hernando Cortez and Montezuma. Now, there's no doubt whatsoever in my mind that if some extraterrestrial civilization decides that they truly want to make their presence known to us, oh yeah, they're going to do so, and nobody will be able to hide or cover it up. For all we know, the interstellar versions of the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria may already be on their way toward Earth. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Perlant, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
I'll look. There are three flying saucers, and I can read the names on the side. A Pinta, Nina, and Santa Maria. Oh, that sounds familiar.
Exactly.
Very odd. Until you named them, I had nailed the names. And I thought, oh, I hope he doesn't say the name so I can be brilliant. The SETI people may have some sort of agreement with somebody that if they do get a signal, they'll notify somebody first before we find out.
Yes, exactly. If they do have an agreement that says, oh, yeah, well, you have to notify us first, and then we will decide how it is to go out or not go out. I could see that happening.
And, of course, there's the school that says we already made a deal with the aliens back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Or even earlier with Eisenhower.
Yeah, it goes way back in terms of figuring all of that out as to what may or may not have already transpired. But, again, we're interpreting based on our own logical thinking. You know, to say
logic?
That...
You call that logical thinking?
Well, no, I'm calling it logical in terms of the fact that we would presuppose that the aliens would turn around and decide to contact the U.S. and the U.S. president and basically cook up a deal with him. They really could be kicking around going, you know, I really don't give a damn about these guys. I'm just curious as to what the hell they're all about.
I guess it all boils down to nowadays, who can you trust?
Yeah. If they do show up and decide to say, hey, you know, how you folks do? We're here. We'd like a little bit of, you've got that blue stuff, water. Yeah. Can we have some of that?
Yeah, we need the gold for our motors.
Basically, all of a sudden, we're sitting there going, so what do I do with these beads?
Do they have a USB port?
I can see some of those things, and it's scary. Because I really do feel very strongly about the fact of the infamous Brookings report.
Hoagland, how could anybody have missed this?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Maybe it's time to play that clip again for the new listeners who haven't gone back far enough into the archive.
Yeah, sometimes we make the assumption of everybody that's listening and knows as much as we do at times. I don't think I know very much, so that's scary. By the same token, though, hopefully it'll make them go take a look even closer. It's going to be interesting to see what happens when it comes out, when eventually there is no doubt whatsoever that we are being visited. And I just want to know who.
It's all right seeing flying saucers, but what interests me is what's driving them, not what is creating the power for them to do that.
Exactly.
I want to know who the pilot is.
Yeah, I want to know the guy or the girl or the it.
I want to know
the wheel.
Well, food for thought as always, Dave Perlant.
That's what we try and do, I think.
We shall continue to do, and probably till our last breath.
I think so.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good one, as always. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Think that make you go, hmm. was a study commissioned by NASA of a group of prestigious Americans from all walks of life, academia, politics, law, economics, etc. It is called Proposed Studies on the Implications of Peaceful Space Activities for Human Affairs. It was prepared by the Brookings Institution in Washington as a report to NASA and subsequently was communicated on April 18, 1961 by NASA to the U.S. Congress Committee on Science and Astronautics of the House of Representatives of the 87th Congress First Session. What's important about the Brookings report is what you read on page 215. There is the beginnings of an interesting discussion titled Implications of a Discovery of Extraterrestrial Life. It says, anthropological files contain many examples of societies sure of their place in the universe which have disintegrated when they had to associate with previously unfamiliar societies espousing different ideas and different life ways. Others that survived such an experience usually did so by paying the price of changes in values and attitudes and behavior. What the document was warning was that if NASA were to discover extraterrestrials or even their artifacts, the social consequences conceivably could lead to the, quote, disintegration of civilization. And what you have to ask, I had to ask myself over and over and over again, Hoagland, are you crazy? How could anyone have missed this?
Few weeks we head across the pond and join with our British contributing editor, publisher of Alien Worlds magazine, Stuart Miller. He lives in Altrincham in Cheshire, and on the line with me is Stuart Miller. Good day, Stuart.
And a very good day to you, Errol, and everybody listening.
A fairly exciting time politically in the UFO world. Have you been observing such things from your side of the pond?
I'm actually puzzled by your comment. Politically in the UFO world, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
What are you referring to?
Well, I'm talking about exopolitics and the secret UN meeting and...
Oh, yes.
It was somewhat tongue-in-cheek.
Right. I was kind of going to come at that, but not quite in that way, because... The point I was going to make was that it strikes me that at the moment there is a vacuum within ufology. There just seems to be a chasm that's opened up. A number of people seem to step back for some reason. It could just be a temporary thing. It could be that there's just nothing of a great deal of interest around at the moment.
I do think the latter is the reality of it. Not much going on that's tempting to any of the serious people involved in the field.
That's what I just said, but then check myself, because, for example, Stephenville, which was a major sighting, one of sufficient size to get MUFON up and out, and whilst there has been a tremendous amount of what I would call peripheral rubbish attached to it subsequently, the fact is that a large number of people did see some things in the sky, and I would have thought that the nature of the Stephenville sightings would have been sufficient to have rekindled interest for a lot of people, but it doesn't appear to have.
I think some of that has to do with the fact that a lot of people are waiting for the MUFON Texas report on the Stephenville sightings.
All right. I think one disappointment in the last couple of years or so, a year and a half, whatever, has been O'Hare. I really don't know what's happened with that, because it just seems to have just been whisked away from people. That is very strange indeed.
Doesn't that usually happen with all of the, and in quotation marks, major UFO cases, that there's a big hubbub about it, some people get involved in looking into it. Officially, it's all denied in one form or another, and it dies.
Maybe it's just a matter of impression, and my impression is different to yours here, but it struck me that O'Hare was just whisked away from under people's noses, that the shutters seemed to just come down big time for some reason, and it might have been something to do with that film actor, what's his name, the one that's heavily into UFOs, buying the film, or allegedly buying some film footage of it.
Danny Aykroyd.
Yes, he was allegedly reputed to have bought some of the film. But I mean, it's just dead, it's just there's nothing. It's really as if the shutters have come completely down on O'Hare in a rather strange way.
And it's mystifying, I must admit. Almost as mystifying as the case itself.
Yes, indeed. And for whatever combination of reasons, there just seems to be a hole within ufology at the moment. And into that hole are stepping people interested in things like the UN meeting and, well, exopolitics and so on and so forth. And it's all getting a bit pear-shaped at the moment and a bit superficial and, dare I say, unedifying even.
Well, of course, there's also a major scattering of information sources now. As each month and year goes by, there are more and more places for people to go read and find out about UFOs. And some of them are okay, and others are not nearly as okay. So there's a dilution of interest there.
Well, I'm not sure that things have changed substantially, say, in the last 2 or 3 years. I just sense, for some reason, a curve downwards. I'm not going to say a curve downwards in interest, because I think there is still a substantial element of interest out there. I think there's been a downward curve of interest amongst, quote, the specialists, the people sort of inside the subject, as opposed to those outside, those that are not involved in the subject per se, but who take an interest in the subject. I think amongst those people, there is still a very big interest. It's odd, this, actually, because one of the biggest criticisms certainly we've had in the UK, but I know it's spread worldwide as well, are these irritating Chinese wedding lanterns that keep popping up. In fact, I have a strong suspicion that that news item that you put up just quite recently, I think the heading was UFO gave me the heebie-jeebies or something. I think if you read that, it's fake. It becomes obvious fairly quickly that the guy's possibly looking at some sort of light in the sky, or if it wasn't that sighting, it was one a day or so ago.
Oh, was that the nurse one in Denbighshire, Wales?
No. That one is actually very interesting. That one actually relates back to the Berwyn Mountain incident, which is entirely explained and completely nailed down because Andy Roberts, the researcher and skeptic, says it is, because he was the one that dug into that a few years back and produced what is, I must say, generally referred to these days as the definitive report on the subject. But, you know, Andy defends his position vigorously and will not countenance really much criticism of his findings. But in general, I wouldn't actually disagree with what Andy says about that incident. The nurse, I should explain, was one of the major witnesses involved in that episode, because the people that lived at the village at the bottom of Berwyn Mountain heard this very loud explosion and presumed that a plane had crashed into the mountain. And because this lady was a nurse, she started to make her way up the mountain looking for wreckage and so on and so forth. What Andy Roberts alleges occurred was it was a combination of an earthquake, possibly a bolide, and confusion about lights in the sky, because there were meant to be poachers on the mountain hunting rabbits, and they were doing this at night, and they had torches and so on and so forth. So it actually became a very messy, you know, there were lots of potentially different confusing routes you could go down to try to follow this case. There is no doubt there was an earthquake, actually, because I forget the name of the society that records earthquakes in the UK, well, internationally, actually, but they're based up in Edinburgh, and they did register an earth tremor that day at that time. Possibly a meteor sighting or bolide sighting at the same time. But then, you know, you start to throw coincidences about, and it gets a bit, begin to push the boundaries boundaries of probability, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes, it was probably some combination of natural phenomena with the confusing element of lights being seen on the mountain as well. But a number of people jumped on that and claimed it was a UFO crashing and so on.
Paul Devereux, who is in your latest issue of Alien Worlds magazine, holds very strongly to Earth lights around fault lines, and if there were, in fact, an earthquake, it's quite possible that there may have been momentary lights popping up from that.
You are quite right, although he, I'm not sure he's ever alleged that in connection with Berwyn, to be honest.
No, I wasn't suggesting that he was, but he was very much on the side of Michael Persinger at the University of Sudbury in Northern Ontario here in Canada, who suggested that what people were seeing was not UFOs, but either earthlights or things in their brain that were generated by the electromagnetic properties of power lines.
But what Devereux said was that the earthlights themselves could possibly cause memory problems or problems to do with hallucinations. But I just want to take a step back from that and qualify something. I don't think Devereux is alleging that every light in the sky is an earthlight. I think he is offering earthlights as a partial explanation for some of the things that people have seen. We talk about percentages, we talk about residue percentages, unknowns. That figure varies enormously. I would really be interested in knowing if the unknown percentage, whatever that figure is, if you take an optimistic 20, 21, 22% that some people might argue, or even a little bit more, or really pessimistic figure of 2 or 3%, I want to know if that is what I would call a net-net figure. In other words, does it mean that even natural phenomena like earthlights have been extracted from that? And I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. Or if it's possible, if you then dive into that small percentage or that residue percentage, and then you can extract other things, you can take out other things, or more other, further sort of possibilities as well. Yes, you can probably account for earthlights, or earthlights can account for some sightings, but I don't think that Devereux is saying that it explains every sighting of lights in the sky or whatever that people have claimed to see. What is interesting, speaking to him, is that there is, I'm not quite sure I would call it a bitterness there, there is sort of more cynicism towards ufology. I mean, he's certainly very keen to make the point that lights in the sky or the earthlights have got absolutely nothing to do with extraterrestrial intelligence. I mean, that's obvious. But by the same token, he's not saying there's no such thing as aliens. It's just that the phenomena that he's concerned with has got nothing to do with it.
Is he more on the paranormal side? Because I've seen him write articles for Fate magazine about hauntings.
I actually did use that word when I was speaking to him, and he's actually a very disturbing man to speak to, really disturbing, profoundly so. I think possibly a lot depends on the depth of your imagination or just how your imagination runs, but it actually scared the crap out of me, but to be honest, I don't think he was trying either. Coming back to your point about paranormal, I'm not sure he'd actually use that word. He would probably, I can't remember exactly how he replied to me when I did ask him about that, but it was something along the lines of, you can call it what you want. It's not a word that he naturally used. One of the stranger things about some of these sightings of lights, and this is something that's been observed many times before, is that there does appear to be a rudimentary intelligence, not a sophisticated one, but some sort of intelligence, or it is certainly, their behavior is certainly capable of being interpreted in that way. It could be a misinterpretation. For example, he quoted one instance where somebody, I think it was John Keel actually, was out somewhere at a well-known spot in the States looking at these lights and shone a strong light at them. And they responded to that. In the past, these lights have been observed to descend upon someone or an object, not actually descend upon them in a threatening way, but sort of play around them in the way that a cat might run around somebody that was walking along a road. Sorry to jump about here, but again, coming back to your original comment about Persinger and people being affected by the electromagnetic
fields from power lines.
He acknowledged that point, Devereux, but also said that he knows plenty of situations where people have encountered lights and they haven't been affected at all. So, you know, he doesn't fall one way or the other on that.
Which to me suggests that those lights have different sources.
Well, that is entirely possible. His frustration with science is that this is a phenomenon that's been known about for many years, and it, particularly within some communities, known about and used. For example, in the UK, there used to be a tin mining tradition in Cornwall. All the tin mines in Cornwall have now been long spent. But Cornwall used to be quite world famous almost, actually, for producing tin up to about maybe 30 years ago. And it has a long history going back many hundreds of years. And he has spoken, he tells me, Deborah, tin miners who said that when it rained, they would often use the lights, as they referred to mine in. In other words, they didn't need any other lighting. These naturally produced lights, which, and he mentioned rain, so there seemed to be a connection there, were sufficient for them to carry on mining. I don't know for what period of time or anything, but there was sufficient light there for them using these earth lights to actually mine tin. That's a tradition that goes back hundreds of years. Now, what is going on there, I don't know. But he is particularly interested in the nature of the power that is produced. Possibly a plasma, but how's it being produced? Where's it coming from? And why does it appear possibly have what he referred to as a rudimentary intelligence?
And that's what's really intriguing about it, other than how's it produced. It seems to have a rudimentary intelligence. Dancing lights around your ankles.
Yes. The more you talk to Paul, the worse it gets, so to speak. I never used to pay much attention to window areas. It was interesting, actually. Frank Warren put out a report, which normally, I don't think I would even have bothered reading, or I might have read like the first two or three lines, because prior to speaking to Paul Devereaux, it wouldn't have particularly interested me. It was simply a report from a woman who had, in the company of, I can't remember if the gentleman was a boyfriend or a husband, they'd been sat on their porch one night somewhere in the States, and they had looked up and had seen an orange shape of some sort that seemed to look like a door, and then possibly changed shape slightly. But that was it. There was nothing about flying saucers, UFOs. It was nothing to do with that. It was just simply something odd in the sky. And the specific reference that caught my eye was it was door-shaped. And that is something that Paul Devereaux does mention in the interview. And the implication is that, well, you know, you can take your pick here. He started whittering on about or making references to quantum physics and string theory. When I say whittering on, I don't mean he went into it in any great depth. He didn't go into it at all, really. With sightings like that, we're possibly, I must stress that word, teetering towards
interdimensionality.
Well, yes, okay, you sort of grasped or grabbed the words from out of my throat. Yes, something along those lines. And apparently that door shape is a classic shape. It's actually a mathematical, I can't remember what he called it.
But it's in the interview.
Yes, but it's surprising how many people see these things. Same shape.
In one of the interviews that I've done with Nancy Talbot of BLT Research, the Crop Circle research people, if a listener goes to their website, bltresearch.whatever it is, it's in the program listing, there are photographs of these little lights, these little orbs that they came across in crop formations.
Yep.
Actually, you're the first one I've ever heard say that some of these lights are door-shaped. I've never heard that before.
I'm not sure it's the same type. It's a different type of light in the sky. Earth lights, I think, jig around. And obviously there frequently is, geophysical connection. Probably the most famous site in the world is Hestelen in Norway. But also you've got Martha in Texas as well. The type of thing I've just been talking about, these door-shaped things, I think don't move around quite so much. Although, having said that, if they do move around, I think they move around, and I think what they do is they disappear and then reappear.
In the same spot?
No, in another spot. They go and they reappear, but where the earth lights, you can trace them. They stay in vision until they disappear, so to speak, and they don't necessarily reappear again.
Is Devereaux suggesting that these are possibly portals?
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, he's not suggesting that earth lights, that you were talking about more than one thing here. Earth lights fly around or move around. They might disappear, but then another one will reappear. I think if you saw them, you would recognize the difference. The sort of thing I'm referring to here is in many ways more sinister.
Mm.
It tends to be more static, but if it goes, it can reappear suddenly. I think in one instance he described it as like three fields away or something like that.
Are they close to the ground or are they up in the skies?
They're in the sky, but not necessarily that high up. It could be treetop height, maybe a little more. It varies, but you're not talking about what I would call flying saucer height.
So it would be very difficult for the observer to step through that door.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes. No, you couldn't do that. No. Well, to my knowledge, you couldn't, no.
Taunting. Look, I'm a door and you can't step through it.
Well, maybe you can if they were at ground level, but I'm not sure I'd want to.
I look forward to reading the Paul Devereaux interview.
It is on its way to you. You will probably have it in the next couple of days.
I loved the last issue.
Well, thank you.
And look forward from what you posted to the UFO updates list about it, and presumably elsewhere, but the various interviews and writers is quite impressive.
Well, thank you. I mean, if we're talking about Paul Devereaux, I was particularly pleased to get hold of him because I think that his ideas are worthy of looking at again, and I think he had a hard time over 20 years ago now from the UFO community when he first stepped forward talking about Earth lights, and I guess I can understand why. It wouldn't have been the sort of explanation or rationale I would have wanted to have heard a few years ago about UFOs. I know what I want. It wasn't that these things are from here. In many instances, if you get into what he's reading, he actually has the ability to make it sound worse, in other words, more threatening.
Scared the crap out of you, I think, is what you said. Yeah.
In some ways, what he says makes perfect sense in a way. And what I mean by that is this. Look at us. Look what we do. We look up in the sky. We look to other planets. We are interested in life from elsewhere. But do we really know much about what is underneath our feet? And when you think about it, when you think about the ecosystem, when you think about the biosphere, when you think about all the dynamics of this planet and the unbelievably complicated and powerful mechanism that this planet is, when you look at it like that, it isn't then surprising that it possibly throws off some bizarre phenomena which, at this stage, for whatever reason, we haven't really got sorted out yet, either because we don't think it's worthwhile or whatever. It's not really surprising that people do see strange things, that there are such things as ghosts. However you might explain the paranormal, there may be a hard and fast scientific explanation for it, or it may be something genuinely weird. Either way, it's not surprising that such a phenomenon exists. Not when you think about what is under our feet, what is above us within the Earth's atmosphere, when you think about all that electricity, all that, everything, we underestimate this planet. We just don't think about it enough. In that sense, as people interested in ufology, we are guilty of ignoring our own planet.
And everything else that is labeled paranormal. Because, as I've said many times over the years, I'm firmly convinced that it all meshes together, not just UFOs, but parapsychology, reincarnation, ghosts, yada, yada, yada. All of that stuff all fits into that sphere that is this planet.
Well, hold on. You might well be right. But if you're right, how do you expect, if a UFO lands, why would you then expect an alien to climb out of one? Because if you link all of those phenomena together, and you might be right in doing that, surely that then detracts from the possibility that an extraterrestrial is piloting a UFO.
That's assuming that one believes that those objects are being piloted by extraterrestrials. As we said earlier, there's the dimensional thing. Michio Kaku talks about 11 dimensions in his string theory and chaos.
Are you not an advocate of the ETH?
I don't know. I can't advocate what I don't know and understand. I'm very, very curious about many things. But whether they're aliens or us coming back on a day trip in a time machine from somewhere in the future, or they are us from another dimension, you know, we have doppelgangers elsewhere, in parallel universes or whether they're aliens. I don't know.
That's interesting because there are some people in ufology, arguably incorrectly, but are absolutely respected individuals who are adamant or convinced, shall we say, about what the solution is and are just seeking proof of that.
Unfortunately, a lot of those people are what I call blinkered ufologists. They're not prepared to look at things that parallels the phenomena that you and I are talking about at the moment, UFOs. There are many other things going on.
Well, yes, I know. I agree entirely. Absolutely. It took me a while to get to that point because I certainly was, I think, very ETH-orientated to begin with. I think it's reasonable. Well, some people would say it's completely unreasonable, but it is reasonably my estimation to say that possibly UFOs have got absolutely nothing to do with extraterrestrial life.
Possibly.
In other words, two very, very separate issues.
Well, maybe, but until somebody actually does some in-depth research into UFOs, and I mean the somebody's being at the university level and higher, then we ain't going to know.
Well, at the risk of sounding like some continuously ongoing advertisement, I do want to say that we kind of touch on that as well with this guy I talked to called Dr. Jeffrey Bennett, who's brought out this book called Beyond UFOs. Now, this is a NASA man who says that, well, people have seen UFOs, fair enough. What could they have seen? Then I think we discussed him last time, actually, I was on. He was of the opinion that science would love to have it conferred to find evidence that UFOs are intelligently piloted craft from somewhere else. He thinks that the fact that nobody has really discovered any evidence acceptable to science in that area so far stops a lot of other scientists getting involved. Regardless of how you view that, the fact is there still exists a phenomenon that needs to be looked at, and you end up in a vicious circle. Well, we haven't really, after 60 years of people seeing things, we haven't really got any evidence or evidence that is acceptable to science. Therefore, your average astrobiologist isn't going to get involved because it's unlikely he's going to get a return, then the subject remains unexamined.
And again, their funding and their tenure is threatened.
Well, there is that as well. Mm-hmm. But, you do tend to get different points of view on that, you know. I mean, it's very common for people to say what you've just said. And in fact, I've said it myself, you know, that scientists won't get involved because their tenure gets affected. And it has to be acknowledged, to some extent, we have evidence of that in relation to, I forget the gentleman's first name, but he is an astrobiologist. His surname is, I think, Gonzalez. Can't remember what university he was at. This is something that's happened very, very recently. Hmm. But he was refused tenure because of his belief in intelligent design. And this was a scientist. So, yes, it's certainly, we do know of people that have had, well, of course, it was Dr. Mack.
And Dave Jacobs.
Yes, yes. But I also hear other people and scientists themselves not mentioning that at all, that side of it, and saying people would love to get involved, but they need some sort of incentive that it might lead to somewhere or something. It just depends who you speak to as to kind of what you get on that. But yes, science needs to step in at some point. If I may move on, because there's been an interesting report, for want of a better description, a gentleman by the name of Professor Andrew Watson of the University of East Anglia, which is in the UK, has produced a very interesting report which suggests that, in his opinion, intelligence is a rare cosmic commodity. He's not saying it's a rare Earth situation. He's not saying we're the only life in the universe, but he's suggesting that our expectations in terms of the frequency of intelligent life might be over-optimistic. He's basically produced a model, as, of course, the way you always do. And he's got it down to four major steps that would bring the origin of life and then bring that life to a level of intelligence. The first step is the emergence of single-cell life, which happened here about a half a billion years after the Earth was formed. The second step is the development of multicellular life, which happened about 1.5 billion years after that, in other words, after the emergence of single cell life. Specialized cells allowing complex life forms with functional organs, presumably arms, legs, and so on, that occurred a billion years after the second stage. And then finally, and oddly enough, or maybe not, the development of language a billion years after the third stage. He says you need those four steps in order to develop intelligent life. There's a big question mark in my mind about that last point, human language. Of course, we need to be able to communicate, but that's like the chicken and egg situation in my mind. If you have got a being that is developed to the point where it's capable of speech, speech will follow because communication will follow. Language would develop naturally in my mind, but those are the four points he is alleging that you need. The problem that intelligent life is fighting against is the planet itself that it might be on and the sun that serves it. To cut a long story short, basically he is arguing that there isn't enough time in many places for all of that to happen. And on that basis, he calculates that intelligent life may not be as common as we hope. I have to say that Seth Shostak comes back at him with a very good response, which is that we've only got the one example to look at of intelligent life, and that's us, and that we cannot possibly have estimated all the elements that go into the evolutionary process. And so, effectively, he's saying to Dr. Watson, you're guessing. But nevertheless, yeah. I thought that the way that the guy developed his argument was interesting. It's an interesting theory, even if in the end it gets knocked back down.
The thing is that with the number of suns, stars, that there are out there, the chances of there being other intelligent life on an inhabited or habitable planet are extremely high.
They are, but maybe I didn't emphasize or develop his argument. I mentioned these four major steps, and I said that what they were sort of up against was the planet they were on and the sun. They're the sun that supplied, that serviced that planet. In talking about those four major steps, we were talking about billions of years, but as you may have heard, our sun is going to give the ghost up in, I think it's about 5 billion years, but well before that time, our planet will have become uninhabitable because the temperature will have risen. Nothing to do with global warming, just everything. And that's the point. It takes billions of years for that level of life to develop. And if a particular sun, even if it's in what's known as a Goldilocks situation, it's perfectly positioned and so on, it could just be that there isn't enough time before the sun burns itself out for intelligent life to come to the boil, so to speak. That's really the crux of his argument.
That I can understand, but we did.
Yes, indeed we did, and I tend to agree with what you said. Even if by chance his theory and his reasoning is right, you always come back down, I think, to the same point, which is that it is just so vast out there, so vast, that really the issue is not is there intelligent life or how much of it there is.
Yeah. When you look at the number of supernova that are being seen now, exploding stars, there's almost a half a dozen a week.
Yes. You know?
Yes. And those are the suns that have gotten to the point that ours will in 5 billion years. So if we're getting, let's say for the sake of argument, 20 a month, then imagine how many suns are actually out there, and we're not seeing those suns explode in real time. That happened millions, if not billions, of years ago. The speed of light that it takes that flash to get to us is millions or if not billions of years.
Absolutely.
So yeah. There are billions and billions of stars out there with even more billions of planets revolving around them. The odds are huge that there are other beings out there. And maybe visiting us, whether they're coming physically across space and light and time, or whether they're coming to visit us from another dimension.
Well, if they're physically coming across space, then I strongly suspect that what we would be seeing would be robotic, developed robots. I'm beginning to come to that.
Little greys.
Well, like Data in Star Trek. I think we'd probably be looking at something like that, which is a Shame. I'd like flesh and blood.
Yeah, especially Peter Khoury's blonde and alien, huh?
Yeah.
The Australian hair wrapped around Peter Khoury's penis that Bill Chalker has been investigating.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, oh dear.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say that word on a podcast?
Penis?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I said it on the radio. In fact, in the last podcast, I repeat an interview that nobody had heard other than the people that were listening live with Bill Chalker about that case and the results of the DNA testing on that hair that was wrapped around the head of Peter Khoury's penis. The podcast is online and available. Feel free to go grab it and take a listen to Bill Chalker. I know you have huge amounts of time to do all of that stuff.
I mean, dive back in, yes.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. Yeah. Usually they take DNA samples from the root of the hair, but this time they took DNA samples from the center of the hair and from the root, and they were different in the two spots.
Yes, I remember reading that.
How does that happen if there are not genetic experiments going on around us?
Very briefly, in closing, before I close, I just want to sort of complain, I think. I mentioned Stephenville earlier, and I'm going to mention it again. There's the story that's come up. It's actually had a couple of different titles, but it's the same text. The version I'm looking at is headlined, Man Claims Alien Abduction by an UFO in Stephenville, Texas. I think elsewhere it's Eureka Springs UFO Watchers Find Fewer Sources.
Yeah, I posted that, yes.
Right. Two completely different headlines, but exactly the same story. And I'm complaining about the way the story is written up. If you read it, it's what I call very insidious, but what it does is it makes everybody out to be a complete idiot. Okay, that's not exactly news, UFO land, but I just thought we'd got past that sort of garbage.
No, we haven't, not when mainstream media are covering the subject.
Oh.
I mean, there are still complete idiots, I think, is the expression, who really don't bother to do any background research and who will go to something like the Ozarks Conference and cover it and go with their own bias, not having done any research at all online. And Lord knows that gets very difficult for those mainstream media type people to do nowadays, because there's just so much of it out there and so much crap that features front and center on so many websites. So they go to a conference and cover it with their own uninformed, uneducated, unresearched biases. And that's how they write their story. And I think that's what happened with this one.
Yes, very clearly, yes. It was just disappointing, I think, to read it. And I think the guy that was being written up will, when he reads it, be disappointed as well.
Not happy. I noticed that Ted Phillips was mentioned in there too.
You're quite right. Although I think my recollection was that they didn't do a treatment on him.
No.
They just reported verbatim or what he spoke about without comment.
Fluff and padding for the main thrust of the story, which was that people who were into UFOs are loonies!
Yes.
And so you and I and the listener are all crazy, and we should all be wearing tinfoil hats to keep them away from us.
Oh, no, you know, you don't need to wear a tinfoil hat to be crazy. You see, the sad thing is, though, Errol, the truth of the matter is there are people within this subject who are beyond strange. I don't like my humans, and I don't expect my human beings to come in uniform
packages.
Exactly. Where everybody thinks in a conventional manner within certain boundaries and so on and so forth. So, in other words, what I'm saying is I certainly expect and indeed rejoice in some of the eccentricities that you find within ufology. I mean, I'll give you a good example, and I'm going to get into terrible trouble for mentioning him, because he found out, and I'm talking here about Ed Gurman, he found out a couple of weeks back that I had referred to him as bonkers in a forum somewhere. I think it was on Nick Redfern and Greg Bishop's UFO Mystics. And he came storming on saying, you and I have got a problem. And I managed to explain the context, and I think he went and had a look at it as well. It somewhat pacified him, although it didn't get away from the fact that I'd still called him bonkers.
And by the way, he subscribes to this podcast.
Hello, Ed. I think what I was trying to say, now I've got to explain myself, was that, you know, Ed, you are perfectly normal, but slightly eccentric, if you follow my thinking.
Yeah. Bonkers is a gentle way of saying a little out in left field.
I wonder if Ed would actually disagree with that. He probably wouldn't.
Oh, I know. I'm sure he wouldn't.
But we started this off by me criticizing this article.
Yes.
Or basically suggesting that certainly the people at the OSARC conference, if not everybody within ufology, is a nutcase.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to say, well, you know, we know people. It doesn't take too much mental effort to sort of think of people that are seriously beyond the pale.
The exopolitics people.
Well, yeah.
Oh, that'll make people like Stephen Bassett happy.
Okay. I tell you, the guy posted on UFO Updates a couple of days ago about some images from Mars. Did you look at them?
I did.
Could you see anything?
No, not really. The only one was where he pointed out that there seems to be a feminine figure, a shattered sculpture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I couldn't. Really, other than the rock that looked as if it might be a dog face or a pig face or something, there seemed to be, but that's Rorschach tests, you know, that's inkblot psychological testing.
Well, yes, you might be right. You might be right about that. That's true. I remember posting something up on Updates where I had genuinely seen, I can't remember what it was I thought I saw in some, but I was perfectly serious and put it up.
And they jumped all over you.
Yeah, well, a couple of people did, yeah, thinking I was just mucking them about. And I got private emails from people off list saying, yes, I could see that. So, yeah, you might be right. The point I was going to make is that I couldn't see anything that resembled a female shape in those.
No, I couldn't either. And unless you cut out those individual rock shapes and put them together in the way that you thought they might present a female figure, I doubt that many people could see what it was that he was seeing.
Well, yes, you said it could be, what are they, those psychological
tests. The Rorschach test.
Yes, it could be, you know, he obviously saw it. I personally could not see anything resembling a female shape in there at all. Mm. And I was just wondering how, in God's name, he's conjured that up. Well, welcome to the world of ufology.
We've had a couple of subscribers to the updates list post Martian images claiming that they're seeing something in the last few months. The Dutchman, too, or the Belgian.
Yes, you're quite right. And mm-hmm. I say this tongue-in-cheek, but Richard Hoagland is quoted in the latest issue of Alien Worlds. He passes comment on the photo we've got of a scene or a picture of evidence of previous civilization on Mars, the remnants of it. And he is putting his opinion on that in the magazine, but I should say not in a serious context.
AlienWorldsMag.com is the website. And it seems to me from your post about issue number 2 is that it's a little more available in North America now.
I think it's as available now as it was with issue 1. It's just this might sound a bit pathetic, but I only know for sure that it's in some Barnes & Noble outlets. It's certainly not available in every one of them. I think it is available in possibly one or two others, but I just don't know what they are.
So the safest way of guaranteeing a read is by subscribing to it at your website.
Well, if people want to, yes, they would be most welcome, and thank you.
I think that's a good idea. The thing I love, just to go back a moment to what we were talking about earlier, the thing I love about Alien Worlds Mag is that it covers a fair spectrum of stuff without going out into either left field or right field, as far as you and I are concerned, too much. And that's what I loved about the first issue, and looking at the lineup for issue number 2, it looks just as good.
I think that's a very accurate summation. Yes, you're right, goes into left and right field, but doesn't
go bonkers.
Yeah, it doesn't go silly, yeah.
Yes.
You put that very well.
Well, thank you. And you may quote me in future issues or, you know, right under the banner line.
Okay.
The magazine that goes.
Thank you, Errol.
Stuart, thank you. As always, it's an interesting discussion that we have once a month. And let's hope that something more exciting happens in the coming month than has been happening the last few. And who knows, maybe the MUFON report will come out between now and our next gathering, and we'll have even more to talk about. Although, once again, I'm not holding my breath, mate.
Well, no, it doesn't pay to do that in this game. We're all often left holding our breath for a very long time.
Thank you, Stuart.
A pleasure. All the best.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
AlienWorldsMag.com is the website. Go check it out. Alien Worlds Magazine, worth the subscription and more, and it will expand your horizons. In August 1957, now-famed interviewer Mike Wallace was cutting his television chops on a local TV station, interviewing names in the news. Here's the audio, tweaked and tidied, from a discussion he had with then-newly appointed head of NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, Major Donald Kehoe, former United States Marine and author of 5 books on UFOs.
Good evening. Tonight, we go after a fantastic story. The story that flying saucers from other worlds are visiting our planet, just as we are exploring outer space with our own rocket satellites. Our guest is former Marine Air Corps Major Donald Kehoe, who has the support of scores of prominent businessmen, military men, and some scientists in his campaign to prove that flying saucers exist. If you're curious to know why Major Kehoe charges that the United States Air Force is deliberately deluding us when it calls saucer stories the bunk, if you want to hear his own evidence that the saucers are real, and his reaction to the claim of 2 Americans who say they've spoken with men from Venus, my name is Mike Wallace. Major Donald Kehoe is the director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. As head of this private group interested in flying saucers, he's repeatedly attacked the United States Air Force and others for claiming that flying saucers are apparently flights of fancy and not flights by Martians or men from the moon. Independent surveys show that millions of Americans do share his belief in these celestial saucers. Major Kehoe, first of all, let me ask you this. Most people in the United States, in spite of the fact that I say that millions do believe, I think you will agree that most people in the United States don't believe in flying saucers from outer space. They probably hold the view of columnist Bob Considine, who wrote that flying saucers are products of, for the most part, quote, pranksters, halfwits, cranks, publicity hounds, fanatics in general, and screwballs, end quote. How do you feel about Mr. Considine's charge?
Well, I know where he got the story. He got it from Colonel Watson out at the Air Technical Intelligence Center in Dayton. In fact, the colonel went even a little farther, and he said behind every sighting was an idiot, a crackpot, a religious fanatic. That included a lot of high-ranking Air Force pilots, incidentally, and many airline captains, people who were qualified to see these things. But he's just following out an Air Force policy.
Well, now, you're not suggesting that Bob Considine is in the pay of the Air Force. He's an independent newsman with a considerable reputation.
I mean the colonel. No, I have every respect for Bob Considine.
In spite of the fact that he suggests that pranksters, halfwits, and screwballs are responsible for the stories about flying saucers.
Well, I wish I could show him at any time a list of about 800 witnesses, some of the big names in aviation, including up to the rank of colonel in the Air Force. Mm-hmm. They're still flying, and they're still carrying passengers. They've never been grounded. They're still guiding airliners in, the radar men are, night after night in bad weather. If they're screwballs and incompetence, why are they still on the job?
Major Kehoe, where do you think flying saucers are coming from?
I don't know. There is an indication that they could be using Mars as a base. I don't mean they originate there, but every time Mars has approached us in the last 10 years, there's been a noticeable increase in saucer sightings. And that's been mentioned officially. In fact, the Canadian official project, on the basis of that, set up an observation station in Canada.
You say the Canadian official project. What do you mean by the official?
There was an official project called Project Magnet, and they set up an observatory at Shirley Bay to try to track these things.
What happened to the official project? You say there was a project.
Yes, they ran for about a year, and they had one sighting on a gravimeter, which indicated that something, a very large object, had flown over there. But they finally decided they were spending a little too much money on it, I suppose.
Well, certainly they wouldn't have thought that they were spending too much money on it if they believed that that kind of phenomena existed.
A lot of people on the project are still working up there on their own time, and certain government officials have still kept the lid on their reports in Canada, just as they do down here.
In other words, you suggest that they come from Mars or from other planets, from other solar systems, possibly, throughout the universe. Is that correct?
Yes, and there are a lot of scientists who said the same thing.
What is your theory as to the kind of people who fly these, or the kind of beings who fly these saucers?
Well, that's speculation. Willie Lay said recently they'd be just like the man next door, the invaders from space, and his reasons may be good. But most of the top scientists have said that the odds are that beings from other worlds would not be like us. Some of them would be. Dr. Harlow Shapley, for instance, said that there probably were at least 100 million inhabited planets in the universe. And Menzel, who doesn't believe in saucers at all, says that he goes that high or even higher. And among those, they must be, by the law of averages, a certain number of planets that could be like the Earth. And if evolution started at the same time, why, you might have the same type of being.
What do you think are the intentions of these people, for lack of a better name, of these people who are in these flying saucers?
Well, there's been no evidence of any hostility. During the last 10 years, what we call the modern phase, there have been sightings before then. There have been some accidents, Air Force pilots chasing these things. Captain Mantell was killed chasing one in 1948, and two pilots disappeared chasing one in 1953 over Lake Superior. But I think those were just accidents.
Why don't they try to communicate with us? What's your theory about that?
Well, I'll follow some of the theories the Air Force people suggested to me back in 1952 and 1953, at which time we were cooperating. I had a lot of very good friends in the Air Force at that time. The policy was to give out the information. They were about to tell the people everything they had. And the theory was then that perhaps these beings were so much different from us that communication would be a very hard thing. They might not, for instance, have speech sounds like ours. That's one answer. Another thing, they might not be able to exist in our atmosphere. We're going to land on the moon. We'll have to wear spacesuits or else build air-conditioned buildings up there, air pressures. There could be lots of factors like that.
Well, do you think they're down here when we do see them to look at us?
I think that it's probably a long-range survey.
A long-range survey.
That's right.
And yet no attempt, as far as we know in any case, of communication with us.
There have been claims of communication, but most of those have been by individuals. The Air Force has not admitted that there's ever been one, and our committee hasn't found any cases that we would accept as verified.
All right. Now, let's go at it from another point of view, if I may, the Air Force point of view. They agree, undoubtedly, objects have been seen in the sky. But the Air Force has said time and time again, and this is a quote from Richard Horner, Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Research and Development, all but a small percentage of these reports of unidentified flying objects have been definitely attributed to natural phenomena that are neither mysterious nor dire, end quote. Weather balloons, mirages, ordinary sky phenomena like meteors, airplanes themselves. What about that?
I'll answer that, but I'd like to make several points doing it. In 1947, the Air Technical Intelligence Center at Dayton, the top Air Force intelligence men and scientists under contract, sent a secret document to the commanding general of the Air Force saying that whatever these things were, they were real. In 1948, ATIC, the same group, sent a top secret estimate to the commanding general, Hoyt Vandenberg, said these were interplanetary spaceships. In 1952, there was an intelligence analysis of the maneuvers of these things. As seen by radar, triangulation, radar photographs, and in 1953, the Central Intelligence Agency and the Air Force had a special panel of scientists meet at the Pentagon to tell them what to do. And after they got through, this group said, you don't have proof that these things exist, not scientific proof, but you have a very strong circumstantial case. We suggest you quadruple the investigation, set up special observation posts, and in the meantime, release everything you've got to the American people. Now, you've got four documents there that they've been sitting on all this time, and they have been spending a lot of money investigating flying saucers. If they don't exist, why the money? Why did the intelligence teams rush out every time there's a sighting?
Now then, you have mentioned four documents that you claim exist. We've heard in the past that you have claimed that these documents existed. We've seen your literature in which you talk about the existence of those documents. So we spoke with the Air Technical Intelligence Center at the Pentagon earlier this week, and this is what we were told officially by them. Three of the four documents Major Kehoe refers to simply do not exist. The fourth document does exist. You can have a copy of it, Mr. Wallace, and you can see that it doesn't say what Major Kehoe claims it says. We have a copy of it, and I quote to you from the copy. The Air Force document says just this. The panel recommends that the national security agencies take immediate steps to strip the UFOs of the special status they have been given and the aura of mystery they have unfortunately acquired. We suggest an integrated program designed to reassure the public of the total lack of evidence of inimical forces behind the phenomena. And again, as I point out, Secretary Horner says, it simply ain't so. The point really at issue here, it would seem, Major Kehoe, is this. The Air Force says that nothing is going on. Why do you believe that the... It's a fairly serious charge that
I know
you make.
It is.
You make the charge that the United States government is withholding from the people of the United States certain very important information. Why? What would their motive be for withholding that kind of information from us?
Well, I'll answer that, but I would also like to show you some proof that they are withholding it. The reason that was given to me when they were working with me back in 52 and 53 was, first, that they were afraid of hysteria. Remember the Orson Welles show way years back when he scared people into the hills with the idea of invading Martians? They were also afraid that it would upset organized religion. That was a smaller factor, but there was some fear of it. Later, they were afraid that these accidents, when interceptors had chased these things and had been lost or had crashed, might be considered proof of hostility. Now, I would never have put my name on anything if it were a matter of personal opinion. I've talked to and read the reports of hundreds of pilots and radar men and guided missile trackers who've seen these things, and some of them are very important names. The Air Force says they have down to 1.9%, but you'll notice the word current in there. They mean we are currently explaining. Now, I have in my possession a copy of Special Report 14, which is their Bible on this. In the back, it has a table showing that 3,201 cases they examined, 19.5% were unsolved, and they admit they still are unsolved. You add up what they've had since then, it makes over 12% of the reports, and those are mostly from the best possible sources.
Well, now, wait just a second. I'll use your figures. The Department of Defense released an official bulletin on November 5th, 1957, saying that from June of 55 to June of 57, a two-year period, just a fraction over 2% of all investigated unidentified flying objects had to be listed as unknown. 2%. So that's your 1.9.
What was the period again?
55 to 57. The rest were determined to have been balloons, airplanes, hoaxes, and a category about 12% called insufficient information, which means that the report was so flimsy that there was simply nothing to check on. I must confess that they've certainly shown me no classified material, but they have opened their files quite willingly to us in our preparation for this program tonight. And they've given us very convincing evidence, Major Kehoe, that it is largely, I shouldn't say largely, I'll say 99.44% a hoax. Now, you mentioned...
A hoax?
Well, when
I say a hoax...
calling
a lot of good pilots hoaxers.
No, not hoaxers. I thank you for correcting me. Not just a hoax, but let's say misinformation or sightings of objects which seem to be one thing but are in fact another. I'm glad that you corrected me about hoax, because it is by no means that much a hoax. But you mentioned a Dr. Donald Menzel, who's a professor of astrophysics at Harvard before. Now, I think you will agree that he's one of the world's most distinguished astrophysicists. Is that not so?
I think there are others who are equally capable,
but
do not agree with him.
He is one of the world's most distinguished astrophysicists, though I think we can agree on that. In any case, he stresses, you see, that pilots are not expert observers, that they as well as others can see flying saucers when it's only, to quote him, the wrapper off somebody's lunch blowing around in the air, end quote. But again, let's come back to the most important point, Major Kehoe, and that is why will the Air Force, why will the United States government withhold information from United States citizens? For what reason?
Because they're treating them like children, the way they did with the H-bomb at first, and the way they've been doing with other things. Now, I'm not attacking the United States Air Force. I'm attacking a small group in there that has been persistently keeping this from the public, just as they've kept other things. For a long time, you couldn't even mention the idea that we could be hit by missiles from submarines from the Gulf and from both coasts very easily. I knew that years and years ago and tried to get it out, and at the time was discouraged about it. You mentioned this denial of these documents. Now, I'd like to tell you something that happened on the Armstrong Circle Theater. I had requested that those points be in the script, and I was discouraged from it at first by their writer. Then later, some of our board of governors insisted that we have those points included. So I said, either I don't go on, or we have those in there. So I said, all right. So the script was completely rewritten. Now, those were in the script as it was first rehearsed. But when the second rehearsal came along, and the Air Force saw the mimeograph sheet, the Air Force representative, according to the Armstrong writer, said they would immediately deny it on the air, even though it meant denouncing their own former project chief. Now, the source for this is Captain Edward Ruppelt, who was the head of Project Blue Book for 2 years. And at that time, he was considered good enough that he briefed President Truman on these things.
Mm-hmm.
He was the top man. Rank didn't mean anything. It's your experience that counted. All right. He says these things existed. He put it in the book, which was cleared by security and review in the Air Force. On December 5th, 1955, that was cleared. It's in his book. He's never been hauled in and court-martialed. Now, I have here, and if you'll allow your camera to come in on it, this is a sheet from the script of the Armstrong Theater, which was deleted. This was crossed off, and I was told that I couldn't say it on the air. Now, that was censorship by intimidation. This can be matched up with the other sheets from the Armstrong Circle script, and any typewriter expert will show you.
Well, I'm certain that... I'm certain
they ordered it taken out.
I'm certain that people believe you. The only thing is that the next morning I distinctly remember reading a report by you, Major Keogh, to the effect that no censorship, no pressure of any kind had been put upon you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Walsh. I know that statement almost by heart.
Yes.
I said that CBS and the Armstrong people were not to blame for cutting me off the air when I tried to mention the fact that a Senate committee was working on the secrecy angle. I never mentioned this that night to anyone, because I had promised that I wouldn't say anything about it on the air, that the Armstrong people. It was taken out, and I will do this. I will ask the United States Air Force to have the Marine Corps put me on active duty for court-martial, if that is not the case.
Major Keogh, I understand you have three new reports on file which, in your opinion, would convince every person in this country that flying saucers are a fact. Is that correct?
They should convince a lot of people because of the names involved.
Tell us about it.
I told your interviewer in Washington that I couldn't mention the names because they were too high. One of them is a top scientist in this country whose name would be known to everybody.
Well, why wouldn't he want his...
Because he's afraid of the official ridicule.
He's afraid of official ridicule?
That's right.
More afraid of official ridicule than of possibly alerting the country to a serious national danger?
You'd be surprised how many people give us reports, and they say, please keep my name confidential. Well, I'll give you one report which came to us. The name has to be left out. In 1951, a UFO circled the fleet in Korean waters. It circled it at high speed, and they launched several planes to try to get a close in on it. They got a radar lock on. That is, the radar was guiding the planes toward the object. This was picked up by radars on 14 naval vessels. This object circled for a half an hour or more, and then it took off at a speed way over in excess of 1,000 miles an hour. This report was certified, and 9 members of our Board of Governors saw it, signed it, and agreed they had seen it, and agreed to the content.
Yeah.
There is another report that just came in from 4 top missile engineers at one of the big plants in this country. They saw an elliptically shaped object and 2 small round disc-shaped objects flying with it over California, November 11, 1957, at a speed of at least 5,000 miles an hour. These men are well qualified to know what they see. With broad daylight, not a cloud in the sky. There have been cases even where the Air Force has shot at these things. Now, if there's nothing there and they don't exist, why do they shoot at them? You mentioned Mr. Horner. The day after Mr. Horner said that the Air Force was not concealing anything, Captain Gregory Oldenburg, public information officer at Langley Field, refused to let an ad be inserted in the Langley Base Flyer, their newspaper, which asked that anybody interested in UFOs please communicate and form a little group. He said, I must refuse to do this because the dissemination of information on UFOs is contrary to Air Force policy and Air Force Regulation 200-2. And I have a copy of it here in case you want to see it.
Well, Major Keogh, I must say that the Air Force tells us they don't question your motive, but they do question the accuracy of a good deal of your information, and for that reason they say you have been, and were they to, in a sense, throw open an invitation to all people who cite UFOs to get in touch with them once again, They'd get all kinds of cranks, hoaxers, and so forth. And you see, they run down every one of these sightings, and it has cost them a tremendous amount of money to no avail over the past few years.
That's what they told you.
That is what they told me. Now, sir, in the past few years, millions of flying saucer enthusiasts have become excited about the stories of two men, George Adamski and Howard Menger. Both of them claim to have seen flying saucers.
Mm-hmm.
Menger claims to have been given a ride in one by some creatures from Venus. Adamski says he's chatted with a man from Venus in the California desert. Do you believe them?
No.
You think they are hoaxers?
We do not accept any reports of these so-called contactees without more evidence. We've asked them to submit their claims and take lie detector tests. We don't throw them out. We simply say we'll give you a fair chance. I think that's the least important part of the picture. The most important part is the weight of evidence from hundreds of competent people. I'd like to name a few. Captain Richard Case, American Airlines. Captain C.S. Childs, Eastern Airlines. Captain T. Kravitz, TWA. Robert Adickus, TWA. Colonel Donald J. Blakesley, U.S. Air Force, a wing commander.
Mm-hmm.
I could go down the list of people who know what they're doing, and they're still on duty, they're still flying.
Major Kehoe, what would you like to see done about flying saucers that is not currently being done? What steps would you like to see taken?
I think the American people should write to their congressman and insist that open hearings be held by the Senate Permanent Committee on Government Operations, which has been looking into this for 6 months.
An Air Force spokesman told us this last week. He said members of the Senate subcommittee have talked with us already, and they have shown no interest in conducting any hearings on this issue.
I talked with the chief investigator within the last 2 weeks. I gave him a lot of information, and I gave him data on one case where an airliner was sent to chase one of these things, and the passengers kept in ignorance of it at that time. That involves two government agencies beside the Air Force, which has refused to release the report. And I'll say this, if the committee were to get Ruppelt, Major Fournay, several colonels who were on that time, Major General Garland, who was on the project, it would be a big revelation because the Air Force is simply treating the American people like children. They don't trust them with the facts.
Here is, I think, an interesting question, Major. The United States and Russia have started sending satellites into the sky, and we may be hitting the moon with a rocket soon, possibly Mars. You believe that creatures from outer space have space stations on Mars. What's going to happen when we start firing rockets at the moon or at Mars?
That question's already been brought up. We expect to have a base on the moon within the next 5 years. It's possible that there is a base on there. I don't say there was any proof of it.
Is it possible we're going to start an interplanetary war when we start sending our rockets to the moon and to Mars?
In 1935, General Douglas MacArthur said the next war would be an interplanetary war, and we'd have to unite against people from other planets.
One last question, Major Kehoe. Have you ever seen a flying saucer?
I've seen them tracked on radar, but I take the word of about 800 of the best witnesses in this country and abroad.
But you yourself have never seen a flying saucer?
I've just been a reporter, and a careful one.
Thank you very much, Major Donald Kehoe. As you've just heard, the flying saucer controversy is deadlocked in contradictory statements and interpretation of facts. As for Major Donald Kehoe himself, like most of us, he's never seen a flying saucer, which may just make him like a mystic who's never seen a ghost. But one must give him credit. He has much faith.
Well, it came out of the sky, landed just a little south of Moline. Judge fell out of his tracks, I couldn't believe what he seen. He laid on the ground, shook, fearing for his life.
Listening to Mike Wallace's attitude toward Donald Kehoe, it's easy to understand why CBS Television and the 60 Minutes team have not been eager to delve into UFO phenomena. My thanks to Dave Furlott and Stuart Miller for their invaluable input into this program and into your ears. And thanks to you for downloading us. We look forward to the next time we do this. Till then, see you.
That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. J.
join us again for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.